The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I think one of the worse than tragic messages that comes out of this peace agreement is that starvation works, that as a weapon of war, the infliction of mass hunger is merciless and effective. It may be slow, it may take months or years, but it is relentless and it does its job. And it's silent. It's something that if you can suppress information about it happening, the world will not object. And it's possible to co-opt those who are mandated to prevent hunger, UN humanitarian agencies, international governments. It's possible to co-opt them into silence, even collusion in this crime, if you wish to do so.
I'm Tyler McBrien, Managing Editor of Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 22nd, 2022. Earlier this month, officials from the government of Ethiopia and representatives from the Tigray People's Liberation Front agreed to halt a two-year conflict that has been rife with accusations of ethnic cleansing, sexual violence, and famine as a weapon of war. To discuss the current state of the conflict and the prospect of peace, I sat down with Alex Duvall, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation, and a research professor at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. A longtime expert on the Horn of Africa, Duvall co-edited the book Accountability for Mass Starvation, Testing the Limits of the Law, which was published in August. We discussed the terms of the recent truce agreements, the irony of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's Nobel Peace Prize, and the options for accountability for forced starvation and other crimes committed by both sides. It's the Lawfare Podcast, November 22nd. Alex Duvall on the conflict in Ethiopia in Tigray. Now, for Lawfare listeners who may have seen headlines on Ethiopia and Tigray, but aren't quite caught up to speed with how the conflict started, the current status, could you just give a brief overview of, you know, when the hostilities broke out, who the parties involved are, and what they're fighting for?
So the conflict erupted almost exactly 2 years ago. It began as a political dispute between the recently elevated Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, who was presented himself very much as a young, dynamic, energetic reformer, and the leadership of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which was from, as you would expect, from the Tigray region in the north of Ethiopia, but most significantly had been the vanguard of ruling the country for the previous 27 or so years. The other element in this conflict, this dispute, was neighboring Eritrea. There was a long-running, deep and bitter grudge between the TPLF leadership and the president of Eritrea, Isaias Afwerki. And while the dispute between the TPLF and Prime Minister Abiy was primarily political, the dispute between Tigray and Eritrea was far deeper, and the Eritrean leader essentially wanted to crush Tigray and destroy its leadership and render Tigray region as a whole destitute and unable ever to rise again.
And I think some listeners might recall that Abiy Ahmed won the Nobel Peace Prize, and yet he went to war. So could you speak a bit more about him in that transition from, you know, Nobel Peace Prize winner to now, you know, engaged in conflict?
The Nobel Peace Prize is profoundly ironic because the main reason he won that was that there had been a war between Ethiopia and Eritrea some 22 years ago. And that had ended in a truce and an armed standoff that lasted over the intervening decades, with the forces mobilized along the border and the two countries trying to destabilize and undermine each other. But Ethiopia had developed into a relatively prosperous economy. It was one of the fastest growing economies in the world, but had not liberalized. It was still a fairly authoritarian system. Eritrea had become a totally totalitarian system, totally closed, no constitution, no rule of law, no media, no political parties. The only functioning institution was really the army and security services. And Abiy sort of broke the Cold War. He flew to Asmara and embraced President Isaias and said, let's make peace. Now, the content of that peace agreement was never made public. Normally, one would expect in Africa a peace agreement to have provisions for democratization, transparency, openness, monitoring. None of that. There was obviously some sort of secret pact between the two. Nonetheless, it got Abiy the Nobel Peace Prize. But what we subsequently learned was that the pact was really a military pact against Tigray. So ironically, tragically, this peace deal was actually the recipe for a new war.
Now we'll go from one peace deal to another, peace negotiations rather. As you well know, earlier this month, I believe there were two agreements signed between the hostile parties. What was the context in which the parties came to the table? Who was at the table? And what's in these agreements?
So the context was that there were 2 years of extremely bitter war. And the military equation swung one way and the next, and then to the other extreme and then back. But the core over the last year has been that Tigray region was encircled and blockaded to the north by Eritrea, to the south by the Ethiopian Federal Forces. And it was blockaded in that no information was really allowed out. No journalists went in. The last international journalist to be there was in June of 2021. Humanitarian agencies were not allowed to collect or transmit information. But most importantly, no services were allowed and almost no food was allowed in. Only about 15% of what the World Food Programme estimated was the required ration was permitted in. So a starvation siege was imposed. Some academics in Belgium have estimated that of Tigray's pre-war population of 6.5 million, somewhere between 383,000 and 800,000, so a median figure of about 600,000, perished of starvation and disease over these 2 years. That's an appalling death toll. There was no sign of this weapon letting up. And then in August, fighting resumed again, and the joint Eritrean and Ethiopian forces took the offensive, and over 70 days had day and night fighting. And the level of casualties in this war are absolutely mind-blowing. The Ethiopian chief of staff made an offhand remark last week that his army in those less than 2 months of fighting had lost 136,000 dead. And that does not include the militia casualties, the Eritrean casualties, or the casualties on the other side. The overall death toll from this war, from the battlefield and from starvation, is likely to be well in excess of 1 million. Now, what really happened, therefore, was that after 70 days of this onslaught, the Tigrayans, who had been surrounded, isolated, blockade, their material means for fighting were just running out. They were firing off all their bullets, killing thousands and thousands of these wretched conscripts who were ordered to rush their lines. But they could no longer defend their population centers. And more than 1 million villagers were being displaced, driven off their farms, their equipment, everything they had was being looted. And essentially the Tigrayan leadership decided, well, we have to sue for peace, not because we've lost on the battlefield, but because starvation is an appallingly effective weapon of war, and our people are dying in such numbers that we can no longer withstand. So two rounds of talks were held. The first was in Pretoria in South Africa, convened by the African Union, in which the Tigrayans essentially said, we will forsake our political agenda simply in order to have a ceasefire and getting food to our people. And the second round was a discussion among the military commanders on both sides as to how they would actually implement the security provisions of the deal. During this entire process, the negotiations have been between the Tigray leadership, TPLF, and the federal government. Eritrea is conspicuous by its absence from the peace talks, although its army is actually present on the ground in Tigray.
Thanks for giving us a sense of the scale of death. I mean, not only on the battlefield, but also among the civilian population. And I definitely want to get into starvation as a tool of war, and then also, you know, what hopes of accountability we can hope for after that. But first, I want to drill down a little bit on the agreements. A recent piece that you had in Responsible Statecraft sort of made the point that, you know, at first blush, the terms of the agreement might seem favorable for Addis Ababa, but I think you make the point that it's, you know, it's not that clear. Could you talk about the favorability of terms in terms of the parties?
The overall deal, the main text that was signed in Pretoria, is highly favorable to the government. It reestablishes federal authority over Tigray as a whole. It says that the Tigrayan forces ought to be demobilized and disarmed. It reestablishes sort of constitutional order and the rule of law. And it has very weak provisions for protection of civilians, monitoring, etc. It's a little bit more complicated than that, because one of the ironies of this war is that the so-called rebels, the Tigrayans, were actually the ones fighting to uphold the constitution, whereas Prime Minister Abiy wanted to revise it. He wanted to change the federal order to a more unitarist order. So when the agreement talks about upholding the rule of law and the constitution, actually that's a bit double-edged, because there are many of Prime Minister Abiy's allies who will not be happy with that. They will have to cede territory that was unconstitutionally annexed, seized from Tigray, and they will have to accept that the federal constitution, for now at least, is in place. The biggest concession that the Tigrayans appeared to make in Tigray was on the issue of disarmament. Now, that has been clarified in the subsequent negotiations and the declaration coming out of Nairobi in two important respects. First of all, it makes it very clear that nothing will happen on any sort of disarmament front until foreign forces, which means Eritrea, withdraws. And secondly, that the entire process is subject to a joint committee of the military commanders of the national forces and the Tigray forces. And the situation on the ground is that the Tigrayan forces are not defeated. And should the Eritreans withdraw, they will actually be the dominant military partner. So the deal in practice is likely to mean something more akin to the redesignation of the Tigrayan army as a special military force or militia of the Tigrayan regional government, rather than being actually demobilized and disarmed.
And then I think one final question on the aspect of the agreements. What has been the role or not of international actors, namely, I think the usual suspects of the AU, the UN, the EU, and then, of course, the United States?
Well, the history, the backstory to this is quite interesting and important. The US convened a series of discrete, in fact, secret talks between the parties during the early part of this year, in which they failed to reach agreement. They thought they had agreements, but each time the federal government, Abiy, reneged on its part of the agreement. And because the agreement was secret and because the Americans were being quite accommodating towards Abiy, he paid no penalty. So the US was there in the background but it didn't really play an active role in the talks. What's more striking is that the African Union, which has over the last 20 years convened many, many peace negotiations, it's always done that in close collaboration with the UN, including technical experts from the UN Mediation Support Unit, in close cooperation, often usually with the European Union, which is its major funder. It kept all of these out. There were no external technical experts or involved. There were also very little in the way of international diplomatic observers there. And this is going to become a major problem because the monitoring of it really will require some transparency, some a greater level of international involvement. And above all, the financing, not only of the humanitarian program, but also of all the reconstruction and rehabilitation and the financial bailout of Ethiopia, which is bankrupt, that has to come from international partners. And if they're not part of the agreement, they may not be quite as hasty in coming forward with the support that is needed.
Now, as we begin to approach questions on culpability and then hopefully accountability with some of the perhaps crimes against humanity or war crimes that took place, namely starvation as a tool of war, I want to go back to a point you made earlier or hinted at in which the Tigrayan forces, as they began to pull off some, I think, surprising military victories, it came at a cost of leaving maybe population centers defenseless. Can you talk a bit about that gamble and how it may have eased Ethiopian forces to blockade these cities?
Well, essentially what the war had an enormous back and forth. So in the very early days of the war, the Ethiopian Federal Forces and the Eritreans and the militia from next door, Amhara, occupied all of Tigray, essentially. And during a period of about 8 months, they systematically looted and pillaged the region, destroying foodstuffs, medicine, shelter, water supplies, massive amounts of rape, and so on, and also many massacres. The Tigrayans organized guerrilla resistance. They controlled the region. They then came back and controlled the region in June of last year. And since then, until a few weeks ago, they were almost in control of almost all the region and its population centers. But they were not able to sustain a sort of conventional defense. Their defensive lines got worn down by these relentless attacks by the Eritreans and Ethiopians at this enormous human cost. And that calculation essentially became on the two sides, who would flinch first? Would the level of casualties being suffered by these massed ranks of Ethiopian conscripts, would that break the Ethiopian army? Or would the starvation and mass displacement and general distress of the Tigrayan population break the will of the Tigrayan leadership? And the Tigrayan leadership were the ones who decided to submit first. They couldn't bear the human cost. They could have continued mobile or guerrilla warfare. They could have abandoned the population centers and seen the types of mass violations that occurred in the previous phase of the war when the Eritreans and Ethiopians occupied the cities. They could have seen those violations recur. But they decided that human price was too high a cost to pay, so they would not continue the war and sue for peace.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think now is a good moment to step back and ask how we know what we know. I think an important aspect of the search for accountability is documentation. I'm curious, first of all, who has been documenting the suffering that's happening? I know, for example, that former ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda led a fact-finding mission of sorts. And then how do we know what we know, especially in the context of the information blackout that you mentioned earlier?
There have been a number of different inquiries. There were, in fact, the State Department did an investigation into ethnic cleansing in the western part of Tigray and to the question of whether it constituted genocide. And that was never published. And one assumes the reason why it wasn't published was that it would have been inconvenient to have a genocide finding for purposes of US policy. There was a joint investigation by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, with the Ethiopian Commission, which is a government body, in the lead. And of course, that cast doubt on its impartiality. A number of investigations by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Norwegian Refugee Council, and a number of others. Most importantly, human rights experts under the UN submitted a report in September. And the significance of this report is that it found that all sides had committed abuses that most likely amounted to war crimes, including the Tigrayan forces, especially when they were operating outside Tigray in the neighboring Amhara region. But it said two important things. One was that only one party, that is the federal government and its Eritrean ally, were responsible for what appeared to be crimes against humanity, widespread and systematic crimes. And indeed, looking at the pattern of these crimes and the statements coming out of both governments, including some extraordinarily sort of hateful rhetoric, the implication is that committing crimes against the population was not a byproduct of the war, but was the purpose of the war. It really might well have been a overtly genocidal campaign. And the other point they made is that only one side, that is the federal side and the Eritreans, had committed the war crime of starvation through destruction of objects indispensable to the survival of the civilian population on a very large and systematic scale, and besieging Tigray and preventing the flow of essential humanitarian relief.
Now, given these findings, these very, I would say, credible actors and their estimations of what occurred, what options are there for accountability and justice? And I think, you know, you can take this question at several levels, domestically in Ethiopia, at the level of the African Union, and then also internationally.
Domestically, the Ethiopian Penal Code is pretty strong on this. It's pretty strong on its provisions prohibiting war crimes, including starvation crimes. And the previous Ethiopian government, the one in which the TPLF was the lead actor back in the 1990s, did have the office of a special prosecutor to investigate war crimes and crimes of genocide. I think it's very unlikely that the domestic political system will actually rigorously pursue these cases. There is a provision in the agreement signed in Pretoria for accountability under the federal government, but I think there is really no appetite for it. It makes reference to the African principles for transitional justice, which are broadly positive and encouraging, but they focus very much on apologies and truth and reconciliation rather than on criminal accountability. So I think within Ethiopia and within the African system, I think it's unlikely that we'll see much accountability. And I should add that the African Union Commission headquarters is located in Addis Ababa and has aligned itself very closely with its host country, Ethiopia. By the way, actually, there's a rather rich irony here, which is that the AU Commission is located on the very site of the former central prison of Ethiopia, the site of massacres and mass torture under the previous military regime, the prison was known as Alam Bakanya, which means farewell to the world. And it was demolished about 20 years ago, and the African Union headquarters was built on the site. And there is a very small memorial to those who perished there and who lived many years of miserable lives on that site, but very little official African Union recognition of the significance of the place where its offices are and where its leaders meet. The fact that it's a site, you know, that has a deep human rights significance in Ethiopia. At an international level, of course, one would expect that arising out of the peace agreement, Ethiopia and many other countries would not support further UN inquiries going forward. They will basically say that these have been superseded by the provisions of this peace agreement, and they'll do their best to close them down. But I don't think this should deter, in fact, I would be determined that it shouldn't deter independent human rights investigators, activists, lawyers, other governments, the UN, etc., and indeed the ICC, from pursuing accountability in various forms.
Now, speaking of history, or recent history, I would say, I think observers or people familiar with the Horn of Africa might think this sounds woefully familiar. Could you speak about the transitional justice efforts that occurred in Ethiopia just some 30 years ago, and maybe their valence to today?
After the TPLF-led coalition overthrew that military government, they established the office of a special prosecutor, and they actually captured very large numbers of the senior military and political officials of the previous regime and kept them in detention. There weren't any reprisals, and they brought them to court. And quite a few were prosecuted and convicted. And some served their sentences. Some, having served their sentences, were very unapologetic. One of the crimes that they considered bringing to court was the crime of starvation, because the Great Ethiopian Famine of 1984-85, made famous by Bob Geldof and Live Aid, involved the use of food as a weapon by the then government. Sadly, I think there was a missed opportunity for prosecuting for starvation crimes in that tribunal. And the reason really was that the tribunal was overworked. It was very easy for them to document crimes of torture and execution in the urban centers, because there were meticulous records kept by the administration that had carried out these atrocities, and because the survivors and the relatives of the victims were well organized in lobbying for justice. And the trials went on for a number of years, and the prosecutor simply lost enthusiasm and energy for pursuing what was sort of lower profile, less salient cases such as starvation. By the way, we saw a very similar phenomenon in the extraordinary court for Cambodia, where prosecutions for crimes against humanity were brought against senior Khmer Rouge leaders, but no starvation charges were included. Again, because it was easier to obtain convictions for murder and torture than they assumed it was for starvation.
Do those trials and other efforts at justice hold lessons for today's negotiations or the prospects of accountability, or are the parties likely hamstrung, you know, by the same things as the past?
I don't see much enthusiasm for at the senior level for these types of trials and prosecutions. I think that the key lesson that would be learned from what happened in the 1990s is that the importance of accountability and the importance of truth-telling was not socialized in society as a whole. So it was very disturbing to see the explosion of hate speech under Prime Minister Abiy's government in the lead-up to this war and during the war, and the extent to which voices from the past were saying that the previous war against the Tigrayans should have been prosecuted with less mercy and more vigor. And so their lesson wasn't one of reconciliation. It was one of settling past scores. And I think that the failure of that transitional justice mechanism to achieve social reconciliation and harmony and move on is quite striking and disturbing.
So we have these medium and long-term efforts at accountability and justice, but of course we have immediate short-term needs of people for food, shelter, etc. What are humanitarian agencies to do right now? You know, namely UN agencies like the World Food Program or other donors like USAID. What's their immediate role right now?
Well, one of the, in my view, not only tragic, but deeply deplorable aspects to the humanitarian performance in Tigray over the last year and a half, has been that they have remained silent about the extent to which starvation has been used as a crime. Now, I readily concede that humanitarian agencies are in a dilemma here. If the price of you being present on the ground and feeding people is that you have to acquiesce in the narrative of those who are inflicting the suffering on them, you have to, you know, not report on what you're saying, not criticize them. That's a real dilemma. But if the situation is you're actually not even achieving the bare minimum of delivering life-saving rations, life-saving medicine, and so on, where you have hospitals that don't even have aspirins, don't even have basic insulin supplies, where less than 15% of minimum rations are being delivered, what are you gaining by remaining silent? And why is it that the World Food Program, whenever its food warehouses were looted by Ethiopian and Eritrean forces, remain silent? It's quite shocking, because I think that what that did was it encouraged the Ethiopian government to think that it could get away with the use of humanitarian assistance as a political tool and hunger as a weapon. So one of the things that we saw, which I think was really disturbing in the last 2 weeks, was the rationale of the Pretoria Agreement was the Tigrayans conceded their political demands in return for getting a ceasefire and humanitarian relief. Well, they got an end to the shooting. But then what the Ethiopian government did was it went against the spirit and indeed the letter of the agreement and said, we will only allow humanitarian aid to go to places we control, or it will only go when we are allowed to reestablish our administration in other parts of Tigray. And that was not the understanding. It was not the agreement. And even those who are more sympathetic to the Ethiopian government then called them out on it in the Nairobi talks. But even now, today is what, the 18th, so that is 16 days after that agreement was signed, barely a trickle, a handful of trucks of essential assistance have arrived in the Tigrayan capital, Mekelle. And this can't be for logistical reasons. It can't be because there is no guarantee on security, because the guarantees are all there. It is entirely because the Ethiopian government continues to put bureaucratic obstacles in the way, and the international aid donors, beginning with the UN, are simply not standing up to that government in insisting that humanitarian obligations are fulfilled. And it's not only a question of basic rights, it's also a question of political importance, because if aid is not provided, the rationale for the Tigrayans, who are undefeated on the battlefield, the rationale for them to stick to this agreement will disappear. If starvation continues, why would they agree to yield when they're not getting anything for their people in return?
For decades now, I think a common refrain in the international community has been never again. You know, we've seen new norms come about, like the responsibility to protect. The United States has adopted an atrocities prevention toolkit, you know, based on the efforts of Samantha Power and others. And yet we have this situation in Ethiopia where atrocities have occurred. What can we make of these, I think, well-intentioned efforts and their ability or not to prevent atrocities?
And let me add one more to the list, which is that 4.5 years ago, the UN Security Council adopted a resolution 2417 on armed conflict and hunger, requiring the UN Secretary General to report swiftly to the Security Council if armed conflict was likely to cause widespread food insecurity, and noting that the use of hunger as a weapon of war could be a war crime. So a very specific tool aimed at preventing starvation in wartime. And what we've seen is that none of these really seem to prevail in the face of political expediency. I mean, the major problem with the atrocities prevention toolkit is that it specifies that it's an important strategic aim for the US government to prevent these kinds of atrocities occurring. But whenever a particular situation arises, today, as in the past, as in those historic situations that were criticized by, quite justifiably so, quite rightly so, by Samantha Power in her well-known book, A Problem from Hell, situations like Rwanda, like Bosnia-Herzegovina, when there's a political expedience that overrules and is a higher priority than the imperative of preventing atrocities, usually it's that political calculus that wins out. And I think we see that quite clearly in the case of Ethiopia and Tigray over the last couple of years. We see it in the case of the UN and it's the obligations of the UN Secretary General under that resolution 2417 on armed conflict and hunger. He is required to report swiftly to the Security Council. His first report on this topic with Ethiopia up there occurred 22 months after the conflict erupted and the first warnings of famine were sounded. There's a particular tendency, very marked among policymakers and the UN, that they prefer to talk about logistical and funding constraints on alleviating famine, rather than on the criminal acts that cause famine. They rather talk about mercy than about justice. They would rather encourage states and belligerents to adhere to international humanitarian law than they would threaten them with punishment under international criminal law. I think one of the tragic, worse than tragic messages that comes out of this peace agreement is that starvation works, that as a weapon of war, the infliction of mass hunger is merciless and effective. It may be slow, it may take months or years, but it is relentless and it does its job. And it's silent. It's something that if you can suppress information about it happening, the world will not object. And it's possible to co-opt those who are mandated to prevent hunger, UN humanitarian agencies, international governments. It's possible to co-opt them into silence, even collusion in this crime, if you wish to do so. So if we want to see an end to the use of starvation as this terribly efficient weapon of war, we need to up our game. We need to focus our public diplomacy, our advocacy, and our legal efforts on exposing and prohibiting this crime of starvation.
Alex Duvall, thank you so much for taking the time.
You are very welcome.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for other offerings, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.